Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
We stand by our budget proposal.
Mayor Johnson says he's not backing down on his budget proposal's controversial corporate head tax despite a key setback. As Illinois waits on the Supreme Court to rule on a potential National Guard deployment, we hear from retired guardsmen about their role in military service. And warships arrive in the Caribbean Sea as tensions escalate between the U.S. and Venezuela. First off tonight, the mayor of West Suburban Broadview is issuing a civil emergency order. It comes amid threats against village officials and escalating protests outside the ICE facility there. Mayor Katrina Thompson made the declaration after she said a group of out-of-town protesters and non-Broadview residents allegedly attempted to storm Broadview's village hall on Saturday. 21 protesters were arrested outside the facility last Friday, and multiple law enforcement personnel were injured. Some West and Southside homeowners are getting sticker shock with their most recent property tax bills, with an average 30% increase across 15 neighborhoods. Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas' office says the most recent property assessments have shifted more of the city's tax burden from business owners to homeowners, what she calls a record-setting 16.7% increase in the median homeowner's bill. But in West Garfield Park, for example, residential property tax bills jumped 133%, or about $2,000. In North Lawndale, a 99% increase, or $1,900. And in Englewood, an 82.5% increase, or $609. But in Lincoln Park, one of the city's most affluent neighborhoods, home to a majority white residence, the median bill rose just 5.9%. You can visit our website for more on why the treasurer thinks bills have gone up. Chicago Cubs fan favorite Kyle Hendricks is retiring from baseball. The right-handed starter pitched 11 of his 12 big league seasons for the Northsiders, finishing his career with the Los Angeles Angels this past year. Cubs chairman Tom Ricketts called Hendricks, quote, one of the best all-time Cubs pitchers. Among Hendricks' career highlights, 16 wins and a 2.13 ERA in the Cubs' 2016 championship season, where he started the victorious Game 7 of the World Series. Hendricks's 270 games started ranks 10th on the all-time Cubs list. Santa and his elves are back on track for the holiday season, with the CTA announcing its annual holiday train and bus schedule. Back for the 34th year, the holiday train will feature 6 decorated passenger rail cars and 1 open flat car for the big guy and his sleigh and reindeer. The holiday buses are pulling up with a new look, featuring an exterior wrap showcasing the Chris Kendall Market and other iconic city landmarks. And the bus's interior will be refreshed with a gingerbread house-themed layout. Trains start rolling November 28th, buses on the 25th, and we have those schedules on our website. Up next, an important committee votes down the mayor's budget proposal. Our Heather Sharone explains what happened inside City Hall right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Mayor Brandon Johnson's budget proposal suffered a stinging defeat today. A key city panel failed to advance his plan to impose more than $600 million in new taxes on the wealthiest Chicagoans and largest firms. But after the blow, the mayor struck a defiant tone in front of reporters.
We stand by our budget proposal. There are not any magic third options between cuts to core services and layoffs and revenue. Anyone who wants to pretend otherwise is being disingenuous.
Our Heather Sharone joins us now with more. Heather, so it was a confusing day at City Hall. Break down what happened today in the council's finance committee.
Well, despite concerns that Mayor Brandon Johnson hadn't done enough to win support for his budget proposal, he scheduled two key votes today and then scrambled when it was clear he didn't have the votes to send the package to the city council for a final vote. His allies tried to delay the vote, which is what you do when you don't have the votes, but his opponents insisted on holding a vote in the finance committee, handing the mayor a stinging defeat on his tax revenue plan.
Now, we just heard from a defiant Mayor Johnson seeking to reframe the budget debate. What does he want to focus on?
The city has a $1.2 billion budget deficit, and he says it comes down to whether it's going to be working-class Chicagoans or what he calls the ultra-rich who will bear the burden of filling that gap. He wants to tax the ultra-rich, and he says there aren't other good options left for the city.
So at the same time, though, Johnson is refusing to back down from his head tax proposal. He ruled out several other ways that could generate enough new revenue to borrow the budget or slash spending as options. What did he say was off the table?
He says he will veto a budget proposal that raises property taxes, reimposes the grocery tax, or increases garbage fees. Now, that really leaves the city with no good options to fill the budget gap except that corporate head tax, which is fiercely opposed by many on the city council and Chicago's entire business community. But he also ruled out making cuts to the Chicago Police Department, which has a $2.1 billion proposed budget for 2026. Budget Director Annette Guzman said today, there's no way to make significant cuts to the city's budget without touching CPD. And if that's off the table too, there are not many options, good or otherwise, left for city officials.
Sounds like quite a few options that are off the table. So his proposed spending plan also borrowed to cover the soaring cost of lawsuits alleging Chicago police officers committed a wide range of misconduct. How much is the city set to borrow, and what will it cost to pay off that debt?
In all, the mayor's budget proposal borrows $283 million to resolve those lawsuits. And the plan calls for that money to be paid back over the next 5 years, which means it will likely tack on another $52 million in interest costs to that bill. Now, again today, the mayor said that is the prudent thing to do to get these lawsuits resolved and off the city's liability sheet, essentially. And he said he's going to crack down on officer misconduct with a new system that has been required by the consent decree, that federal court order I talk so much about, for 6.5 years.
Yes. What's next, Heather?
Well, the City Council's Finance Committee isn't going to come back until after Thanksgiving, when they will face all of these same problems, but perhaps a little more turkey-filled by then. But no good options and a looming deadline. They have until December 30th to figure it all out.
This happened last year. I think we were hoping we could avoid it this year.
No such luck.
Heather Sharone, thank you.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. Hundreds of Texas National Guard members deployed to Illinois are reportedly being sent home. The move is said to be part of a broader change to deployments after President Donald Trump began his crackdown in Democratic-led cities like Chicago.
This withdrawal represents an unconditional surrender by the Trump administration. But more than that, it represents a massive waste of taxpayer dollars.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration awaits a Supreme Court ruling on whether he even has the authority to deploy the National Guard for the purpose of enforcing civil immigration laws and law enforcement. Joining us via Zoom are retired Major General William Enyart, former Adjutant General of the Illinois National Guard. He's also a former congressman from Illinois and an attorney. And retired Major General Randy Manner, who served as the acting vice chief of the National Guard Bureau. Generals, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. So first, I want to get your reaction to the Trump administration's push to deploy the National Guard, not just to Chicago. We know it's been happening in other cities as well, to combat crime and what he's calling mob violence against immigration agents. General Enyart, I'll come to you first for that question, please.
Well, you know, I think the federal district courts, both in Oregon and in Illinois, have made it pretty clear that President Trump has vastly overstated any problems that have been taking place in Portland and or in Chicago. And it's been a vast overreach on the part of the federal government to send to mobilize National Guard troops, bring them in from out of state against the express wishes of both the governors and the local executive authorities, whether it be a mayor or a county executive.
General Manners, same question to you.
Thing is, everyone has to understand this is totally un-American to use soldiers against our own citizens. This is not what those young men and women signed up for. There's no requirement for this. There is no money for this allocated by Congress. These men and women are not trained in police operations. And it also reduces the readiness of those young soldiers to be able to combat our true enemies from overseas. And it drives a wedge between the American people and our military, which we have worked very long and hard, obviously after 9/11, to restore that faith. And I think it also puts these young men and women at significant risk where the rules of use of force are not well defined. And that young man or woman on the street, that young soldier could be making the best decision they think in the moment, but yet it's not the right one. So again, bottom line is totally un-American, totally inappropriate.
General Enyart, what conditions do you think would or might merit a deployment of National Guard?
Well, you know, that's pretty clear. We've been doing deployments of the National Guard for centuries, frankly. And the protocols for it are very well established. You know, the initial decision is made by the local executive, the mayor. The mayor, after all, is on site. He knows or she knows what the nature and extent of his or her resources might be, and he also or she also would know what the nature of the problem is. And once those local resources are overwhelmed, then the mayor goes to the governor, says, "Governor, I need help." And the governor then looks at the governor's resources, the state resources, whether it might be the Illinois State Police, conservation officers, calling in additional local law enforcement from surrounding counties. All of those are options available to the governor. And the last option, frankly, is the National Guard. And the National Guard can be brought in when a civil disturbance reaches the extent that it is no longer capable of being controlled by local authorities. But it is not the president's job to do this. After all, the local authorities are the ones who are in charge of that community, and they should they not perform to the expectations of the voters, you can rely on the voters getting rid of them the next time there's an election.
So, General Manner, Border Patrol Chief Gregory Bovino, he is now, we know, on his way to Charlotte for a similar mission. He's bragged on social media, without citing any sources, that crime in Chicago is way down since Border Patrol's arrival, despite violent crime having been on a downward trend since 2022. So, assuming that federal agents, you know, their presence did contribute to a drop in crime, is that a long-term solution to crime fighting?
Of course not. And that also assumes that what he said was the truth. And we already know the administration has been misrepresenting facts or making up their own facts about the crime figures in every city. All of us are against crime and obviously would like to have people prosecuted to the full extent of the law, respecting their rights under the law. At the same time, the military is not the method to be used for law enforcement. I say again, they are not trained for this. And so we don't want to put those young men and women, quite frankly, in a situation they're not trained for. And it's also important to understand that the concept of what ICE and Border Patrol have been doing, they've been having unaccounted for use of force. It's only through citizens taking videos of the gross misdeeds in many cases that have been happening that we need to bring this to light, hold them accountable, and ensure that we prosecute the individuals and those federal authorities and just hold them accountable to the law as well.
General Anyard, people probably remember the National Guard's presence here in Chicago back in 2020 during the summer of unrest. How is that situation different from the moment we're in right now?
Well, it's much different because the local authorities requested that the National Guard come in. And the National Guard really weren't doing police work. They weren't doing investigations. They weren't doing stops. They weren't doing vehicle stops. They were essentially backing up the local police forces in controlling crowds and that sort of thing. But they certainly weren't investigating crime, nor were they conducting any kind of raids on immigrants, whether documented or undocumented. So vastly different situation there. They were requested. They weren't forced upon them by Washington, D.C.
And General Manner, you recently spoke to a room full of police chiefs from across the country at Georgetown Law School about how to prepare for and how to work with the National Guard should they be deployed to their jurisdiction. What would coordination look like between police officers and the Guard?
It's extremely important that there be proactive coordination between the Guard and the local police and state police and vice versa. I encourage those police chiefs to be able to reach out to their Guard representatives and to ensure that there are liaisons in place now so that they can have police officers participate in the emergency operations centers at the state, as well as, of course, to encourage a Guard representative to participate in their town or city's emergency operations center for the police department as well. You have to develop the relationships in advance of there truly being a crisis, because the Guard is there to help save lives of the American people, not to watch over them, not to intimidate them. And they are a partner with the police to back them up whenever needed, particularly whenever there are, again, a storm, hurricane, forest fires, or some significant calamity that might require local forces to be augmented to help either establish or restore order and to help save lives.
That's where we'll have to leave it. My thanks to Generals William Inyard and Randy Manner. Thank you for your service. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Up next, a look at what's happening in the Caribbean as tensions rise between the Trump administration and Venezuela's president. USS Gerald R. Ford, the world's largest aircraft carrier, has arrived in the Caribbean Sea, further escalating tensions between the United States and Venezuela. The Trump administration has used drones to strike 20 alleged drug boats in the region, killing 83 people that the U.S. claims are narco-terrorists. The Trump administration also claims Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is the head of the cartel, the Cartel de los Soles. The moves have come under scrutiny for both the tactics and the reasons for them. Joining us with some insight are Lena Brito, professor of Spanish, Portuguese, Latin American, and Caribbean Studies at Northwestern University. And on Zoom, Alberto Cole, professor of law and director of global engagement at DePaul University. Thanks to you both for joining us. Professor Cole, I want to start with you. With these military strikes on the boats in the Caribbean, the administration says that it is going after the drug cartels using drones. Are these attacks a violation of international law? Can they do this?
The attacks may be a violation of international law, but I think what we need to keep our eye on is the more important development, which is the massive U.S. naval buildup in the Caribbean, which I think is being used right now to pressure Nicolas Maduro to leave power. And the administration, of course, is selling this to its base as a campaign against drugs, against illegal drugs. Indeed, lots of illegal drugs are coming from Colombia through Venezuela and the cartels. But the really geopolitical issue here is what the United States may do to push Maduro out. This is really the most important one for all of us.
Yes, yeah, and we're going to get to more of that as well. But critics of the Trump administration say that even if the folks, the vessels that have been struck or bombed, even if they are narco traffickers, that would still need to be investigated. There would have to be arrests and given due process. Is that the case?
Normally that's been the practice of the United States, even with pirates. You know, we arrest them and then we try them and then we sentence them accordingly. So yes, this is a very new development. The administration argues that these people are terrorists, that they're being treated the way we treated Al-Qaeda, but that stretches the definition because Al-Qaeda was planning military attacks against the United States, whereas these people that are being targeted on the boats are bringing lots of stuff that do cause the deaths and injuries to tens of thousands of Americans, but they're not treated as attacks. They're just a very, very nasty kind of illegal trade that's going on. And normally the practice has been to detain them, arrest them, and try them in federal court.
So we've talked about the reasons. President Trump has called President Maduro a narco-terrorist himself, alleging that the Venezuelan president is running the Cartel de los Soles. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, claiming that Maduro is an illegitimate leader, that he interfered with the Venezuelan elections and basically stole it. Can it be all of the above, or is the Trump administration just building its argument and creating the framework?
Now, on both of these issues, the Trump administration is correct. First of all, I recommend to our viewers that they look at the Department of Justice website, the indictment against Nicolás Maduro issued in March of 2020. And it documents extensively his ties with drug cartels. Whether or not he's the titular head of the cartel or not is irrelevant. His regime, very specifically, is involved in allowing the cartels to operate, and it's a major facilitator and makes lots of money from it. And then, you know, the other issue has to do with the fact that the Maduro regime did steal several elections, most spectacularly the last election last year, which by the account of all international observers, it lost by over 20 percentage points. And so it's in power illegally, and its tactic always has been to put in jail effective opponents. They tried to do it with Maria Corina Machado, and they disqualified her from running then, and Mundo González ran in her place as the head of the opposition, and he still beat Maduro by a huge margin. So that election was stolen, and Maduro is in power illegally. On top of that, add the massive amount of misery that that regime has brought to the Venezuelan people. 8 million Venezuelans have fled their own country because of the incompetence and corruption.
Such that we know many of them have fled to the United States, which is an entirely other conversation.
Imagine 94 million Americans leaving. Imagine 94 million Americans leaving this country because of the horrible regime. That's what Maduro has done to the Venezuelan.
I want to get Professor Brito in on here because critics believe that the Republican Party is using the conflict to access oil in the region. What do you think is motivating the Trump administration to escalate and to focus on what's going on in this region?
Well, definitely that's one of the reasons, and I actually strongly disagree with my colleague here about, you know, the evidences that they have provided to show that these charges are true. They haven't shown any evidence. Leaving aside President Maduro, they haven't showed any evidence to any of the people that have been killed. The United Nations High Commissioner has said, without a shade of a doubt, that these are extrajudicial killings. There's no evidence against any of the 80 people so far that have been killed in these drone attacks. So what is happening here is a violation of international human rights law and the agreements among nations that narcotics and anti-narcotics activities are a law enforcement operation, not a military matter. And that's when we see what Trump is doing, the administration is doing right now, is reviving and resuscitated a very interesting historical pattern here that is using the war on drugs as a toolkit, a set of resources, strategies, and discourses, including the discourse of calling everybody traffickers and terrorists, as a way to administer state violence in moments of crisis, which is what we have right now in the United States.
Remind us a little bit of that history and the relationship between the U.S. And Venezuela briefly.
Well, the thing is that in order to understand this history, we need to go beyond the very narrow scope of Venezuela. So everything is about Venezuela and regime change in Venezuela. But really what we need to understand is the U.S. way of addressing the relationship with the rest of the hemisphere and with Latin America more generally. So this is about Venezuela, yes, but it's also about Colombia. It's also about Ecuador. It's also about Cuba. It's also about Central America and Panama. So really this is an strategy for the whole region that goes beyond Venezuela.
Okay, and briefly, I think we're actually out of time. I wish we had more to get even further into this and more about what Professor Cole raised about the growing conflict in the region. We will have more discussions about this and ask you to join us again then. Professor Lena Brito, Professor Alberto Cole, thanks to you both. And that is our show for this Monday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening and catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and a special time, 11. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, wishing all a happy and healthy holiday season.